All right, welcome back to Sheep Farm and another podcast. And we not only got our Christian here drinking. Have you got a bottle of wine, Chris?
Yes, I have actually. Yeah.
That's a surprise. Shock. Yeah.
Bottle of Porto 6.
Yeah. It's no wonder you think I'm talking fast when you're drinking that stuff.
Things slow down when I drink this fast.
Yeah, yeah. We've done a few podcasts in the last couple of days, haven't we? I think this is third one.
Yeah.
Third one we've got. Done. We needed a break. And tonight we've got back, I think it's third time you've been on here, isn't it, Mark?
It is, yeah.
Dr. Mark Nestor.
Yeah, back our, from a fee, by the way.
Yeah, our resident psychologist, just to keep me and Chris friendly. Yeah, I ignored the fee part.
I saw that.
I'm sure he said free.
How much are you charging our Mark as a psychologist? I can't even imagine.
Yeah, it'll be in the Bitcoin.
Yeah, it won't be in pounds anymore. But we generally have quite an in-depth chat. Max sent over a few bullet points, quite interesting ones. And I did a bit of background on some of the stuff that you sort of raised as well. Just remember, if you want to email us on info@sheepfarm.co.uk. Chris is hot on the keyboard now. Just got to get him trained up to do some other stuff, like making cups of tea and that. He's only a chef, isn't he? He needs to make a decent cup of tea. Yeah. All right, Mark, should we start off at the top? I don't know. Yeah. What have you been up to anyway? Has there been anything interesting happening?
Yeah. I've been playing a bit of golf. You don't play golf, do you?
No, I did say interesting.
I don't like sport, but I would actually try golf.
No, don't
get involved.
No. Right. No. It's one of these. I mean, so you're not interested, Dom, but it is interesting because it is so bizarre, because you can be really, really decent 1 minute and then so poor the next. So it's like guaranteed to absolutely humiliate you. So I had a really humiliating time. Absolutely terrible. And you can't explain it without it sounding like complete bullshit and an excuse. So it's one of those moments. It's I've been doing a bit of writing and a bit of I'm in the middle of something I won't talk about now, but when it finishes, maybe I'll come back and talk about.
Yeah, anytime.
I'll just say Yorkshire cricket. That's all I'll say.
Right. Okay. Interesting.
Psychologist. So yeah. That's all. But it'd be very interesting because it dovetails into a surprisingly large amount of the stuff that we
work agenda.
Yeah. All of that.
Yeah.
All of that. So we'll come back when it's the right time, which won't be very long now, hopefully.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. I read you wrote an interesting piece in Conservative Woman. What a Conservative Woman?
Yeah.
Recently. You sent it me over, didn't you? Do you want to enlighten everybody what it was about?
Was it on the Djokovic thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't alone, was I? There's a few people have it's not difficult to point out how completely mad, bonkers. I mean, you know, is it rational? Was it science as science was always supposed to be? Was it a case of hysteria, crazy bullying? And there's so many things to it. But one of the interesting things was to listen to people who've had really expensive educations, incredible level of education, apparently. Well, they have. They paid for them. Who then were saying things that I reckon a reasonably bright 10 or 11-year-old would say, hang on a minute, sir or madam. You've just completely contradicted yourself. You just said something that doesn't fit at all to what you just said a second ago or a week ago or whatever. So the kind of that was one bit of it, that the inconsistency, which has been what we've been facing for a lot of things. And the other one, I suppose, that disturbed me greatly.
Or even the consistency. Might be the consistency of inconsistency.
Well, consistently inconsistent. No, it's good. No, it's good. Consistently inconsistent. You're spot on. Consistently inconsistent, which now people think is consistent. You go on, couldn't we? It's true. And the other one is how few people from all sorts of different places that you would think, no, they're quite radical. No, they're people who usually take the side of somebody who everybody's piling in against. The silence of so many different people. I don't just mean in sport. I don't just mean tennis. With few exceptions, there were some exceptions. One or two, Pat Cashews and John Walker. A few people, you know, have said things. Matt Letizia, a few. But generally, generally silence from so many people who are in such a good position, you know, people who've got real, as it were, clout and credit to be able to open their mouth and people listen, not a word. No. And it's like, wow, something as easy as that, that you could have just said something quite calm, measured, middle of the road, nothing, you know, there's no such thing as COVID, there's no such thing as nothing, you know.
Nothing too radical, yeah.
No, nothing too radical, pretty straightforward stuff, nothing. It's like, whoa, what cowardice.
Yeah,
no more sophisticated term needed than that. What cowardice.
Well, the sad thing is it's been left to people, I suppose, like yourself, who were coming towards the end of your career, because the people with something more to lose, they're the ones that there's more of, if you like. They definitely didn't stand up, whether you're a doctor, whether you're sports person, a personality, whatever it is, an actor, none of them stood up, not one.
No, it's a great point. And you know, I've been 3 years now, literally next week, I think it is, 3 years out of university. And, you know, it's not usual, you know, for people, I didn't really realise this at the time, but it's not usual for people to step out of professor or associate professor type role. They usually stay on until somebody says, you know, you're senile. And that means like 96 or something, or you know, you haven't breathed for the last 2 years. I think we need to, you know, need to take you out the room. It's about that kind of, it's that kind of occupation. So people were really surprised. So I have asked myself, and part of the reason was to be free to do some consultancy and write things I wanted to write. And feel more free, basically myself. But I have asked, what the hell would I have done with so many things that have been happening in the last 3 years? Mm-hmm. Whether it's being forced to use pronouns that I would, you know, want to reject, whether it's not being able to say a thing about, well, you know, the climate agenda is not quite completely
true.
Yeah, absolutely.
I literally just dodged a bullet then, Matt, didn't you?
Yeah, I said it.
Indeed, and it's like dodging a bullet, and it's like, well, this must be a destiny reason. That's a bit grand, but this must be the reason why I'm here. But it's true. I'm like, no, shit, if I was there, I would have said things, because I did in my career, and it, in my own little field of sport and psychology, I did, and it made it harder for me, not massively so, but harder for me, because it wasn't the orthodoxy, which we might talk about psychology and approaches.
Yeah, too right.
Yeah, and so you take a little bit there, but it's only a little bit. It's like a little tap in the face. It's not a big punch. And whereas if I'd spoken out on these matters that have the last couple of years, hell knows what they would have done. And so that I can, you're absolutely right. There must be lots of people there who are having sleepless nights, massive stress, whether they're in any professional field that's remotely connected. And that means, goodness me, what does that mean? That means education, medicine. I mean, this is endless. Journalists who are wrestling with their conscience going, this is so wrong. I need to say something, and they're not able to.
Well, the professor, whether he's still working for Queen Mary University or not, I don't know. It's called Norman Fenton. And he's a mathematician, slightly different field to yours, but he's the similar sort of ilk to Norbert Ferguson. Who, obviously, they're coming up with these models.
They're epidemiology guys, aren't they?
Yeah, his model comes up with total opposite to what Ferguson's models were coming up to, with more of an honest view. And obviously, he's been ostracized. He was telling a story that one of his classes, all the pupils apparently, so he'd been told by the hierarchy of the university, didn't want him to teach them anymore.
I can imagine that. And I've seen him a few times, and he's quite an interesting character. And I look back at his background. And this is amazing that you've got people who are equally well qualified.
Yeah.
I mean, that should already smell massively to anyone. If you've got two, like in Chris's field, if you had two top-class chefs,
right,
absolute top-class guys who've built massive businesses, and they're disagreeing about, you know, what the best sauce is for bolognese, you're going to listen to them, because they've both got, I mean, it's not going to be this one's 100% right and this one is 100% wrong. Yeah. I mean,
don't work that way, does it?
Hey.
It comes down to which one you want to choose, doesn't it? Which you think is the best taste, if you like. It's not that, there's not that different, much difference, is there?
Well, you'd want you'd want to hear them, wouldn't you? And you'd you'd want to hear the pair of them, and then you make your call. But you'd want to hear from both of them in terms of, you know, which way they think you should prepare the meat first, and when the tomato goes in, and when the herbs go in, all the rest of it. You know, whatever. And Chris would have a more expert view than me. And
well, maybe the though, Mac, where everything's black and white, it's got to be one way or the other.
Well, that's what's happening.
No, no grey areas, is there?
Well, and that has to be this kind of fear of having any debate has to be connected to some deeper thing, which is, I really do think we've got to such a dangerous place now, because for a number of years, people are really afraid. When people talk so much about something, it usually means they're not actually prepared to do it. There's been so much talk about choice and about choosing what you want to be and who you want to, and yet I think we're more conformist.
It's the opposite, yeah.
Yeah, the opposite. We're more conformist than we've ever been, because we talk so much about it. It's like we talk about resilience all the time. And the two, three generations ago, they never mentioned the word, and they were as hard as nails in a good way.
They were resilient.
They were resilient.
Talk about democracy a lot now as well, don't they?
Yeah. Well, absolutely. We're talking about
every other word in a democracy, not like China.
You know what you do, guys? You just decided, why did we start talking about totalitarianism and saying it's a brilliant thing? We might get some democracy.
Yeah. Flip the coin. There's a doctor just come out, and I forget his name. Chris watched the film. I didn't see the guy though.
I think I sent it to you. I didn't watch it. Yeah. Right. It was a good documentary. That
he's actually a doctor. He's an Indian doctor who was selling the nonsense right at the beginning. He was also pushing the jabs when the jabs came out. He had two. He worked at a jab center, and now he's flipped because he's seen the real figures of what these things are causing, and he's saying, well, you know, I'm not anti-vaccine, just these ones. And I'm thinking, well, surely, like we've just been talking about with the figures and the bolognese, you've got to question everything now, because the same companies are making the old jabs that were making the new jabs. So you can't just say you're not anti-vax. What you're looking for is the truth. And as soon as they peel away and Pfizer are making stuff that are killing people and not admitting it, then everything they do is under question, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you know, there's a number of things that you've just picked up there, but the use of shorthand terms, sort of labels, basically, to vilify people and stop you before you can even get your point across in your argument, that is, we're at a new law of that in so many different areas. And it's like, well, I tell you what, that is not democracy. Whatever that great Greek word means, right, whatever it actually means, but it must mean at one level the ability of two people to have a disagreement, to actually have a disagreement and then try and find, you know what I mean? Have a disagreement to then see what they're going to do. Are they going to then, you know, walk away from each other, going to find some common ground, what they're going to do? So you've got to be able to have that. If not, one person or group is completely imposing their truth on the other. And it's like, well, hang on. And I got this reaction to something recently. Someone said to me, well, that's interesting, Mark. That's your truth. And that's really nice to come to the other truth.
The new terminology, isn't it? Yeah.
The misconception of truth and opinion now are all joined together, aren't they?
So, absolutely. But that's deliberate, though, Dom. That's been done deliberately. And that's, we talked about it, I think, the first time we came on, about postmodernism.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people, you know, the your seven listeners listening in will know. I think I said the first time we came on.
The cat's listening.
they will know this nonsense, but that after the medieval world, where they clearly knew absolutely nothing, which is why they managed to build the Duomo in Milan and York Cathedral without electricity. You know, I mean, they're idiots.
Yeah. They don't know anything.
They didn't know anything at all. So after that world, it was so, they were just barbarians walking around, you know, killing each other and building York Minster. But apart from that, then we got to the modern world. And we got to the modern world and mechanization and industrialization and in the 19th century, fundamentally, and it, maybe before as well, great enthusiasm and belief that science and technology and mechanization would have all the answers. And then we had some big wars with lots of machinery. And then people are like, hang on, this ain't gonna be the answer. So then we end up, I'm kind of stripping through a lot of things here, but we end up with the postmodern view, which is, look, There is no such thing as the truth. Don't even try to look for it anymore. It's pointless. And it's like, well,
we'll tell you the truth.
But that's what happened though, John, because what happens is you can't live in that. You can't live in that lie. I mean, I put on one of the things here, I'll link it in now, that Thomas Moore, and Thomas Moore wrote a book called Utopia before he had his head taken from him. And what he was writing about was, no, this is a disaster. Utopia is a disaster in the sense of you will always have to work together to try and pursue facts or the truth, and opinions are something else. You're entitled to opinions, but facts are facts. That hand of just, the head I've just chopped off is gone. Oh, my opinion is that it might come back again. No, it's actually gone. Right? The truth is, if I'm sitting here in front of someone and for no apparent reason, I punch them really hard on the nose and I say, my truth there is that I've just scratched your nose and the guy's nose is smashed to pieces. There's got to be something there that's not...
There's got to be something there. I mean, we live in a household where my dad always says, I always speak the truth. We used to question that and get into trouble. But the meaning of democracy is the belief in freedom and equality between people, or a system of government based on this belief, in which power is either held by elected representatives or directly by the people themselves. So we'll go to the word belief. A belief is an acceptance that something exists or is true, especially one without proof. So the belief in freedom is democracy.
No, it's good. It's good in that way, from ancient Greece all the way through the Western tradition and the Eastern tradition, I've no doubt, in their own particular way of doing it. No, that was great. And I mean, in terms of linking freedom, democracy and truth, I bet you some philosopher somewhere will never be able to allow to see their books, but someone will have written that those three will be intimately connected. And if you make a move away from one or other, you break the others, you lose the others. They'll be connected in a way that, you know, is a deeper way than what you've just described. But
yes, exactly. Yeah.
Because that's reality. And I mean reality the way we're talking now. In the way that maybe people hopefully are listening, going, you mean common sense? It's like, well, okay, we'll use that word, but I mean what the philosophers that I like anyway, they call philosophical realism. In other words, this is real. Yeah. What we're doing now and what we are about, and this is real. This is not, you know, reduce us just to some molecules bashing into each other. That's not good. What on earth is that for?
Yeah.
What is the purpose and meaning of that?
Again, the debate. If you think about a debate. Debates aren't, nobody has debates anymore. It's a lot of people who either agree on the same thing or they put people in who are just going to argue the toss. It's not a debate because you're trying to force people to understand or accept your opinion. A debate is putting, like, there's all these things here. Let's have a look at them all. You think that, you think that, you think that. Let's have a look at them all. Nobody's right or wrong. Let's look at them all and see what common sense.
They used to say, and I mean, and not everybody's into this person to say the least, hardly anybody is, but I still read some of his stuff for inspiration now and again. And Dr. Johnson, not least because it's usually taking place in the pub, which I've got down the pub.
We'll come back to that one, yeah.
I've got my list, yeah. And it's taking the pub. And they said that, you see, Dr. Johnson, who shouted, so he had a really strange manner, and he shouted and he hectored, and he was a big guy, and he was an intellectual. I mean, he basically produced the English dictionary on his own, fundamentally. And I don't mean there wasn't English before, but he...
I was thinking Robert Coltrane when you mentioned him.
Yeah. And so he was actually, despite appearances, an incredible Democrat, because he actually argued with loads of people in the pub, as opposed to what the totalitarian does and what the people have been doing to us right now, the elite. They don't argue with you. They're not going to waste the time arguing. They look down on you. They walk away. So the idea of actually sitting amongst people from different backgrounds with different expertise and different strengths and trying to put your point across, no matter how you do it, that is democracy. That is equality. That is you seeing yourself as a full human being with other people. Because the others, after all, that's what's been happening to us. They don't even waste time. They would even waste time speaking to the three of us.
No.
And that's the elite.
The plebs. The plebs. Yeah. It's like that eternal question, who are the elites? A friend of mine who has a big business, when these lunatics did what they did the other day and reduced tax to people that were earning more than they needed, really, he rung me up and he says, why have they done this? I've got staff and now they're looking at me. These people, some of them are sort of on breadline or they're struggling. And now they're looking at me like I'm just basically taking food out of the kids' mouths.
You just answered your own question there, Fatty. That's probably why they did it.
That's what I said to him. I said to him, you know, they want this break. Now, you're not the bad guy. They've done this. They're the ones that are doing this, the controllers, not the politicians, the one behind them probably.
Yeah.
But they've done this because they want that break in society, don't they? They want another enemy to be looked at, if you like.
They did a similar thing when they brought in the minimum wage and they kept putting it up. They put it up quite rapidly. And
quite the opposite way around, wasn't it?
Yeah, like a flip version of it where people started to resent people on minimum wage because they thought they were earning too much.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Which is horrible.
When in reality, they weren't.
Well, no, they weren't, but he went up so rapid because I'm working in kitchens, obviously. Say you've got a young kitchen porter, for example. No disrespect to kitchen porters, by the way, we've all done it.
We've all done it.
And they were on $6.50. Within 2 or 3 years, it went up to £9. And I might be exaggerating or getting that totally wrong, but it was something like that. Now, if you're a little business, that all of a sudden is the difference between that and a chef is minimal. So then you've got the chefs resenting the kitchen porter. Do you know what I mean? So the hierarchy there has gone, and the gap between the guy on the least and the most is got shorter and shorter. So you've got resentment starting there.
Yeah. And the strange thing is with this, even people who they've given this 5% to can't give it back.
Hmm.
There's no way out.
No.
Like the minimum wage. They can't say, well, I don't want the minimum wage or I don't want this extra 5%.
Yeah.
There's no choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just a cat
blanche. Said, your mate's going to be going, I didn't even, and they're going to be like, look at that bastard.
Maybe what he's meant to, maybe what they're meant to do, he, she, what they're maybe meant to be doing with that money. And now link it into another one that I put down there, which I'm sure you'll have a view on for maybe a different reason, is they're meant to be investing that money in China. Because, so let me weave it in the most bizarre fashion that don't make any sense at all. But in terms of the influence of China and the Chinese Communist Party in the last 40, 50 years on world affairs, you know, you can blame them. And I don't mean Chinese people, absolutely not. But I mean the Chinese Communist Party, a totalitarian regime. You can blame them. But actually the bigger blame is with us. Because we have thrown all our industry, technological advances, different types of expertise. We've sold it to them. Supposedly the idea. So I was listening to some politicians in the last since we spoke, and they're like, I thought, they don't really believe this, do they? Are they still trotting this out? That if we trade with China for 40, 50, 60 years, suddenly, miraculously, the Chinese government, the Communist Party, will go, you know what? I think we need to be Democrats. I think we need to listen to each other. You know, instead of all these like these dark-haired guys who are about 94 who all sit on the stage with jet black hair.
Yeah.
No women. They all look identical. And they'll suddenly go, I tell you what, trading with the West, wonderful. They've given us all this stuff. And now we're selling loads of stuff back to them and undercutting them and shutting all their industries. How wonderful. I tell you what, let's be totally democratic and let's ask the rest of the population what they think we should be doing and shouldn't be doing. So I think that we have actually empowered them over a long time. So the end of this little rant is, and whatever you guys will have a view on this and then be more informed than me, but I'm still assuming that we think that somehow China's somewhere involved in, you know, is the Wuhan lab, what is the scene on the Wuhan laboratory? What's all that?
Well,
what's I'm asking your view now, more informed than me.
If I was going to give an opinion, and I think we spoke about this the first time I met you when we were in that summer night where we were around at the house,
romantic.
I think there's a lot of sounded romantic. Yeah.
But he wasn't. No.
Yeah. They were
summer night, Matt.
They were eating pizzas, I remember rightly, and I were hungry. No, the Wuhan lab, I think, was a bit of a misnomer. If I'm being honest, if we think a bat could start whatever the story they sold us, then yeah, anyway, that's, I think,
then the immediate
nonsense.
Conspiracy theory was lab and all that. To be honest, I think it was all just a stage show, the whole thing, if I'm honest.
Well, look, they had pictures of people collapsing in the street and
face down.
Yeah, and then there were stories that 5G had just opened. That was the first place that the smart city.
Well, that was the catalyst.
5G.
The catalyst to get everyone terrified, wasn't it? When you were showing pictures of people falling down in China.
Yeah, and they were getting sprayed and stuff. Yeah, it was. I think the whole thing has been a psyop from start to finish. And going back to China, I agree. But if you think about after the Second World War, there was no China. China was funded in essentially by the British and Americans to arm them. And so why would they arm Russia and China so much, knowing that they're probably going to fight them, or there's going to be some sort of conflict, even if it were made up conflict further down the line? There's a great guy, Professor Anthony C. Sutton, who wrote some books, The Best Enemy You Can Afford, or something like that, where he found from the Hoover Institute all the records that the Americans had funded the Russian army. And likewise, when they've gone into China, we've basically funded them, whether we've given them all the industry or not. We funded it, haven't we? And a lot of British companies own factories out there using Chinese labour, or utilised factories out there. They didn't have to do that. And going back to Thatcher allowed all this stuff to start happening. I think it was Nixon, weren't it? They were first American... since World War II to go out to China.
Ping pong diplomacy and all that stuff. And, yeah.
But who was with him? Who was with him? David Rockefeller.
Yeah, I'm sure.
These guys have their hand deeply in that. I mean, he were there with a can of Coke, I think, if I remember the picture right.
One were a Pepsi president, one was a Coca-Cola president.
That's right, yeah. And David Rockefeller were there, I think.
I'm under the opinion, and I might be wrong, but I've been under the opinion for a long time, and I think the last 2 year nonsense just solidified it. And I've said this before in our podcast. I don't think there's any countries. I think they're left for us to squabble about. China did this, we went and did that. I think their stage show is the whole wherever, and it's just like watching a film or a stage show or a play where there's goodies and baddies, and this guy did this and this guy did that. I don't believe any of it anymore, if I'm honest with you. I could be a total crackpot.
But I think, like corporations, like Pepsi and Coke, yeah, sometimes they work against each other, sometimes they work with each other. And there are families or bloodlines or whatever. I'll run a scenario, right? Trudeau, lunatic, yeah? Talks, like you said, there's no sense comes out of him. He's an actor. I know we're talking about something different from China, right? But when you look at his bloodline, and I've mentioned this before, his bloodline from his mother, the Sinclairs, his grandfather Sinclair, he came over with William the Conqueror, the Sinclairs, yeah? They went up to your neck of the woods, Scotland, and the Sinclairs built the Roslyn Chapel of Da Vinci Code fame. They also wrote the Scottish Rites of Freemasonry, the Earls of Roslyn, yeah? Along with the Stuart family, the old royal family. So now we've got all these politicians in power that have these royal-type bloodlines. Boris was a cousin of the Queen. Cameron was a 12th cousin of the Queen. Blair was the 11th cousin of the Queen. All these people that are related to this royal bloodline, mainly illegitimately for some reason. And so that puts a different slant on the story we've been told, in my opinion, simply because why aren't we told this? Why aren't this, you know, how is it that, I think it was something like the last 47 presidents are all related to the royal family. It's some ridiculous number. That's
bizarrely. I mean, that's interesting what you're saying, and you know,
I know we're probably going a bit too far for
someone
who's
listening, yeah. Because I'm thinking this, that, you know, 600-800 years ago, like, just pull those kind of figures out.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in my history. And then you go, well, of course, you have to get from the right sources and all the rest of it, of course. And then they don't all agree. Well, that's a good sign. And all the sort of things we've been talking about. And it's like, well, it was kind of understood that the, let's call them the elites, the aristocracy of Europe, the royal families, the big players, that they were all not in all cases, but mostly hugely interrelated and connected. Yeah. And that was kind of understood by, if you like, the peasant in Lyon and the peasant in Cologne and whatever. If you just give it a European context.
It were accepted, weren't it? Universally accepted.
They kind of knew that this was, you know, this is how it works. They're not going to go and, you know, they told you, well, you know, there are reasons for it to do with royal blood and all these. Oh, yeah, I see it's got, you know, has that got more red blood corpuscles than somebody else? Anyway, right. Royal blood and all that. But we kind of people, I think they probably knew and understood that this was a sharing of power to retain power. And they understood that. And then maybe if you go in with your eyes open into that, then that the, you know, the let's call them the balancing forces against, of which there always are, whether it's individual people or people as nations, or it's whether it's a religious perspective, there's always balancing powers to keep that going. But maybe, now you're saying it, maybe we're more duped, because I'm just thinking about, you know, what happened a couple of weeks ago with the Queen's death and all the coverage and all the coverage and everything that's there, and lots of different aspects to that. But in terms of just speaking to, you know, one or two people who are, you know, I know who I thought knew quite a few things, and how amazed they were at any type of
questioning, you know,
like,
of it. Yeah,
yeah. It's like well, the Queen must be the most English person that's ever walked the earth.
No, she's German.
Well, not fully, but yes. But
yeah, you know what I mean. Yeah.
And it's like, I'm not, and, you know, of course, I'm like, are you going to make a racist statement? So I'm not making any racist statement at all. It's just, you need to know that this huge interrelationship between the royal families of Europe, and that's fine.
Well,
that's
even incest was rife going back hundreds of years within royal families, and the marrying of cousins, first cousins, and you know, all these things were just like the normal thing.
I think I've told you that story, Fatty, where and it was I was watching an art show. I think I might have mentioned it maybe before, but I was watching an art show once, and it was about paintings, and it was about paintings of the royal family in Spain, in Barcelona. And you know when Spanish people say chirezo, and they go, chirezo cottage, and they go, they put that little lisp in. Right. It's because they were imitating the royal family, because they were that inbred, right? And this is from the painting, this thing about paintings. And it was showing the paintings of this royal family, and they all looked exactly the same. The men, the women, they were ugly as sin, by the way. They all looked exactly the same, but everyone had, you know, worshipped them. And they all had a lisp. So they said, like, chirezo cottage or Barcelona. So that's why, if you speak to a Spanish guy, no, I'm not joking.
No, no, you're not joking.
Spanish now. Yeah. They say Barcelona. They put in the lisp. They go Barcelona.
Like Manuel or Fawlty Towers. Yeah.
But they put in the lisp on. Say chirezo. They go chirezo cottage.
Well, it's only Barcelona. Like white rice. And
that's
brown.
Why I never knew. Honestly, Mac, I'm not even making that up. That's true.
It's only like white
that
rice.
And, that's what's better than that. It's to do with the Moorish influence, and that's what I thought it was. It was like,
well, I never thought about it until I saw this document.
All right,
ties in what you're saying, because they all looked exactly the same, and I mean exactly the same. Horrible, creepy.
What this spells out, though, is something else that's more sinister. Is the fact that, let's just say, people have a go at us for Oxford bashing or Cambridge bashing, but we're certainly not, right? There's nothing wrong with universities or anything like that. The fact is that some of these people are picked out. It's like a talent. It's like stars in their eyes or something. There is a talent pick. So some of these peoples, let's just say Boris Johnson was the cousin of the Queen, yeah? How would they know to pick all these prime ministers that are cousins of such and such without following their progress through in some sort of planned way? There is no way they would know, in my opinion, because you can get thousands of people go to Oxford, and yet all these same people seem to become prime minister or not. There's some that aren't. I mean, I've looked into Liz Truss. She's not. But they've generally got somebody behind them. I'll use Kwasi Kwarteng as an example. He was chairman of a secret group called Le Cercle. And Le Cercle was set up by French intelligence after World War II and taken over by MI6. And he was chairman of this group. And so was Zahawi before him. And so was Rory Stewart. And all these people were ex-MI6 and intelligence operatives. So does it surprise us that Quirting's there at this moment in time looking after the coffers and destroying everything, you know? And no. I know it's a different subject, but... Well, anyway, I mean, I've hit on about 20 things.
That's really interesting. So I wondered what your take was, whether you thought it was... Is it genuine? Are we to take it at face value? Because it just seems so outrageous. It seems so tactically such an incredible thing to do. The the superficially black comment.
Yeah, on quasi-apartheid.
I didn't get that. What was
did you hear about that?
Did you hear that, Chris?
No. Mark, explain. Yeah.
Well, I try and explain it as best I can, but this is a senior Labour MP, and I think it was
Rupa Hook. Hack Hook. Yeah.
Yeah. Hook. Yeah. And I think it was not a major speech. I think it was like almost an unguarded moment. Maybe not, though. Maybe not. That's what I'm wondering. Yeah. Maybe not. And she was talking about quasi-quarting and saying, you know, quite a few things. I can't remember exactly word for word, but she's basically saying, when you listen to this guy, if you can't see him, you would be amazed to find out that actually he's black. You'd be amazed. And then she said, he's superficially black. And then she dug herself into all sorts of other holes. Yeah. And so, of course, the general response to that has been, I mean, I've not heard this one. This is the one that struck me straight away. And again, it's like, is this we've been played because it's so crazy. It's like, is she really saying? So she's saying, look at him. He's been to public school. He's Oxbridge, all the rest of it. Well, I think she's something quite similar. I think she's maybe from, I might not be correct with this, but I think she's from at least part, if not full, Indian ancestry somewhere.
She's Bangladeshi.
So she's also been highly educated, good schools, et cetera, et cetera. So it's like, what a weird one,
that, isn't it? That even adds to the argument that she's Bangladeshi.
Exactly. It's weird. Yeah. It's my take on it was that she was saying, because he doesn't sound like he's from South London, he doesn't sound, his grammar's good. And it's like, it was deeply, at face value, incredibly racist. The most unbelievable.
What, do you think she wasn't talking about him being black? She was talking about him being from South London?
No, she was saying that he should sound, at least my take on it, is that he should sound, when you listen to him, not like an upper class, upper class boarding school, Oxbridge, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant. He shouldn't sound like that at all. He should sound like someone from South London who, according to...
Rude boy accent. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, she went to Newham College, Cambridge.
She's from the same world.
Yeah. I remember Chris Rock doing a sketch about Colin Powell saying the same thing that everyone says. Doesn't he speak well? Doesn't he speak well? And what they meant was, he's black. He should speak like he's from the hood.
Well, that's right. That's what this is. I've not heard many people saying that. They've said things like, this and that and the other. And it's like, no, wait a minute. What isn't what she's actually saying? And it's an unguarded moment. It's like, wow.
Well, I look at her background, Mark, and I think...
Right.
I look at her,
she was a lecturer at University of Manchester and sociology and criminology at Kingston University. But she's also, and we see this a lot with MPs, they contribute to newspapers, don't they, Chris? Always got a column that seems to pay them whatever... 25 grand a year, but she's written for the Tribune, Guardian, Statesman, the Times. And she's right in the middle of the woke stuff as well.
I would say it's a plant, that story.
She's covered.
I'm overly paranoid, Matt.
You must have known, because it was so crass, like jaw-dropping. It's like, what do you think the agenda is then on that?
It's hard to find out, it's all news is kept in the news, the woke, the racism. So now you've got an Indian or a Bangladeshi woman now being racist to a black guy, or sounding that. So what's going to be accepted or not accepted probably is so nobody can not be racist is what, because it used to be that anybody brown could take piss out of each other and nobody said anything. Right, whether you're Asian, black, and having but now there is no lines in the sand, is there? There's no boundary.
Yeah.
You know, it's not black and white anymore. It's brown and black. And it's a bit, what's next? A lesbian being done for calling somebody transsexual. It's the same principle, isn't it?
Yeah.
Total fragmentation of everything.
Total fragmentation of everything. Yeah. The breakdown of the entire fabric of how we live.
Yeah.
You can't be funny anymore. You can't have a joke about, you can't do mother-in-law jokes for our community. You know, it's that type of principle, isn't it?
Do you remember, I think it was the last one, or maybe the first one, how the heck we ended up talking about this? I have no idea. That's normal. But for me, anyway. But I can't remember now which existential writer it was. I'd like to say it was Martin Buber, who was a kind of like philosophical, theological writer in the, you know, the 20s, and he had another dimension to him as well. It might have been him, it would have been maybe Rollo May, saying that eventually what will happen if we don't watch out, if we keep down this path, is that there will be utter and complete silence between each other.
Yeah.
Total alienation from each other. And then eventually total alienation from ourselves.
Yeah.
And I think if you talk about identity politics in terms of what's actually happening at the moment, that breakdown is clearly visible. It's happening all around. And people are only seeing the symptoms. They're seeing depression and anxiety and psychological breakdown and increase in suicides. And I think we've actually got to a stage where it's really, really apparent that people are not communicating. This is going to lead into the pub boys in a minute. They're not communicating with each other in any authentic way.
Because they daren't.
They daren't. They daren't because you will have to be there to communicate.
Traumatized. Yeah.
You'll have to take a risk. You'll have to open your mouth and say something that won't come out perfectly because words are imperfect. You'll have to then struggle with the other person to try and find a place. So the safer place to go is silence. And then you have silence with yourself and they can't even face themselves, which is a strange concept until you think about those moments when you might say in English, bloody hell, I'm sick of myself.
Well, the programming is that heavy, Mark, is that even certain things, like, for instance, thinking about using a plastic straw, even would make me, whoa. But that's pure programming. It's not because it's logical. Or even, I always think of this, I probably told you this, though, is, for instance, you're not allowed to do an Indian accent or an African accent or
Irish,
a Chinese accent.
Yeah.
Irish, maybe not too bad. But point is, you can do an Italian accent, that's all right, for some reason.
Yeah,
you can do a French accent, that's all right.
Yeah,
if you go to an Italian restaurant, you can order some lasagna in an Italian accent, and you know, you think it's great. You go to an Indian restaurant and order a korma in an Indian accent, you're a racist. Well, how did that happen? What does that mean?
Well, I've got a little theory on that impulses, I don't mean in a Freudian sense, I mean ideas, if you like, but impulses is a word for the moment. That if you block them up in certain places, they build up and they come with great force elsewhere. So I've laughed throughout my life, an ironic laugh, that you're allowed to make fun of the Germans, you're allowed to mock Italians, you're allowed to mock the Spanish, and you're definitely allowed to make fun of the French. But if you say anything about any of the ex-colonial Commonwealth, as it were, which is deeply patronising. That's deeply patronising. As if they can't, if those people themselves can't say, if you don't mind, you bloody Anglo-Saxons.
Or as if they can't differentiate between it being aggressive or just being fun.
Absolutely.
And totally ignore the demolition of the Aborigines and the Maoris. Ignore all that stuff.
No, that's all gone. You're not going to do that. So it's all on safe territory. So actually, I listen to people and they're like, Oh no! We've got guilty conscience because of what our great grandparents did, and it's like, no! Your great grandparents did some great stuff, some okay stuff, and some absolutely bloody evil stuff in your empire. They did all, because that's usually what every bloody empire
is. We still are.
All three, and it's like, but we can have a go at the Germans, or we can make fun of the French. It's like, what are you doing? Yeah. What are you? And not even in an amusing way. So I think so. I'm going to now call them out. I've met more left-wing academics who were genuine racists about Europeans because they no longer could say some of the things that they were thinking about other people who they were no longer, as you say. To me, in their heart, they've just changed targets. I would trust them as far as I could trip them.
I'd rather have an out-and-out Nazi racist, to be fair. At least you know where you could, you know, at least you know where they're coming from, don't you?
Well, as long as they're not in your house, but I agree.
But at least you know they are, don't you?